Lecture 3, Indus Valley Civilization.
Welcome to our exploration of a long-lost and still only partially understood ancient Bronze Age civilization. Located along the lower Indus River, this urban-based society was as technologically developed as any in the entire ancient world of its day, roughly 2600 BCE to 1900 BCE. Indeed, the Indus River civilization covered larger territory than many of its more famous and roughly contemporary ancient cultures, including those along the Nile in Egypt, between the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia, and along the Yellow River in China. After 700 years of flourishing, the Indus civilization declined and then dissipated. Its people and cultures and their descendants evidently spread across the Indian subcontinent, where they form a major but often unacknowledged part of India's society today. Along with the Adivasi culture that we already discussed and the Veda culture that we'll look at in the next lecture, the Indus civilization was a major source for ancient Indian society. When we look at the region where the Indus civilization once thrived, we find vast urban ruins and many buried artifacts, including seals bearing symbols and writing. But there remain many mysteries without enough historical evidence to resolve them. One vital question is where the people of the Indus civilization came from originally. Second, how did they think about the world and organize their own society? And finally, why did they leave their cities and mostly migrate away, and where did they go? In this lecture, we'll consider these questions and discuss what we can and cannot know about the Indus civilization based on this tantalizing archaeological, artistic, written, and technological evidence that has survived for 5,000 years. We'll also see how the people and culture of the Indus civilization are a continuing strand of Indian history from ancient times down to the present. You'll recall from the last lecture, the earliest people who came to South Asia are known as Adivasi. We know that they were moving through the forests of India, hunting, fishing, gathering wild plants, and practicing forms of Swidden or shifting agriculture from about 30,000 years ago. And they may have been there for many thousands of years before that. But due to India's climate, little physical evidence like wooden houses or tools or skeletons survive from these ancient Adivasi. And they left no written evidence either. Nevertheless, since many of the biological and cultural descendants of these Adivasi still largely live in India, we can listen to their oral traditions and analyze samples of blood and saliva that they give in order to reconstruct their migration patterns and genetic heritage. But when we now turn to the second major source for later Indian social and cultural traditions, the Indus civilization, we have almost opposite kinds of challenges. People of the Indus civilization dispersed nearly 4,000 years ago. They left fascinating but also tantalizingly incomplete evidence about themselves and their achievements. Relatively few of their skeletons have been discovered, and we've not been able to use DNA testing on them so far. They left no identifiable oral traditions. While they left extensive written evidence, we've not been able to decipher it yet. But we can use various sophisticated archaeological tools to learn much about the ancient Indus buildings and artifacts. By about 2600 BCE, people living along the lower Indus River in western India had already developed extensive and intensive settled agriculture along with livestock husbandry. At that time, the lower Indus plain was far more fertile and well-watered than it is today. Scientists have found extensive pollen from that time period, suggesting the richness of the plant life in the area. water-loving animals thrived. These early Indus communities don't seem to have followed Swidden agriculture, so they weren't what we would call Adivasis. But they may have originally developed from once Adivasi communities who innovated new forms of agriculture and pastoralism that set them on the path to a more complex and urban-based economy and society. The Indus population may also have included immigrants from the Iranian plateau, along with some who may have come from elsewhere in the Persian Gulf region or from Central Asia. The few skeletons that have survived suggest a physically diverse population, so they seem to have been many different peoples and cultures that came together in a dynamic synthesis. Over time, these Indus communities developed agriculture sufficiently to produce a food surplus. They grew wheat and barley, but not rice or any of the spices we now identify with Indian cuisine. They also fished extensively in nearby rivers. All this extra food enabled some members of their society to devote themselves to specialized tasks like artisan production and trade, religion and governance, record keeping and art. Gradually, towns grew up and some of them became cities as large as a square mile in extent, with the surrounding agricultural villages providing grain and other food in exchange for hand-manufactured products and governance from these urban people. Cotton was cultivated, which artisans then wove into cloth or twisted into cords or used for other purposes. As the economy continued to expand, these cities came together into a well-organized and multi-city society, which we now call the Indus Valley Civilization. But after some 700 years, this civilization declined and dispersed. For dozens of centuries, knowledge of this Indus civilization was lost as its abandoned cities decayed into ruins and were buried under yards of wind-blown earth. Then, starting in the 1920s, British and Indian archaeologists began to explore the intriguing mounds of rubble in the lower Indus plain. The local people had long known about these ruins and had used them as a source for fire-hardened bricks, intriguing stone seals with curious symbols and images on them occasionally appeared on the ground. But the land had long become relatively arid, so there were not many people living in that area. As archaeologists began to excavate these mounds of rubble, they discovered, to their surprise, that beneath were the buried remnants of entire cities. As these excavations gradually expanded over the following decades, even more startling discoveries were made. By now, several large cities have been largely unearthed. One major city, called Dilavara, is now in the Republic of India, along the coast. In a drier area, it has more elaborate water channeling and other reservoirs than other excavated cities. Two other cities, the largest found so far, are now in Pakistan, and we call them Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa. Often this entire Indus civilization is called Harappan civilization after that city, one of the most extensively studied. In addition, many other smaller towns and cities have been found throughout the region, which extends about 1,000 miles up the Indus River plain. As archaeologists dug deeper into the ruins, they found what had been amazingly organized cities with surrounding walls, straight streets, an extensive system of sanitation, substantial houses, and what seemed to be large public buildings like assembly halls, grain storage warehouses, and bathhouses. The city walls, like the houses and other buildings, were of fire-baked bricks, carefully built up high. These people did not use any cement or other mortar, so the skilled workmanship of the bricklayers is especially remarkable in being able to make them strong and stable to that height. Unlike cities in other civilizations, the walls of Mohenjo-daro and Harappa were evidently not designed mainly for defense against major military attacks. Indeed, there is very little evidence of any kind of warlike activity, such as weapons. That would suggest that many of the walls weren't intended to keep out armies. But these walls would prevent people, especially those laden with grain or other goods, from entering or leaving except through a few city gates. In this way, leaders could collect taxes from people entering or leaving the city, or at least to keep track of them. The straight main streets in each of the cities shows how organized the society was and remained throughout its long heyday. In many other civilizations, the cities grew up haphazardly, and so the roads were often winding and narrow in places. But in the Indus civilization, the straight main streets, largely oriented north-south and east-west, must have been planned. In addition, over the centuries of these cities' history, the roads remained in the same place, with the house walls on either side built ever higher as sedimentation occurred, but always along the same lines. These cities also had elaborate sanitation systems with large and watertight sewage drains leading from toilets and bathing rooms inside houses into collective channels beneath the streets leading to soak pits. This kept wastewater separate from the drinking water system. No other civilization in the world at that period, or for many centuries afterwards, had such effective forms of waste disposal. At least one large building in each city seems to have been a public bathhouse. At each bathhouse's center sits a sizable pool, the bricks pitched to be waterproof. Wells enable water to be drawn up to fill the pool. Surrounding it are smaller rooms, perhaps dressing rooms or places for massage or washing. Since the culture devoted such attention to sanitary disposal of waste and to bathing, it suggests how concerned the people were with the personal and public health and hygiene, distinguishing them from all other human cultures of their age. In the larger two-story houses that have been excavated, the walls facing the street are blank, with relatively narrow doorways leading into separate entranceways. This indicates that people wanted a well-defined private space within. Each substantial house has its own private bathroom. This also accords with their evident commitment to purity for the household. While some of the cities have impressive buildings near their center, none have the vast palaces or temples that would indicate a powerful king or priesthood characteristic of other contemporary civilizations. Mohenjo-daro and Harappa do have, on the western side, a large platform that some scholars call a citadel. More exposed to the coast and its dangers, the Lavera has a more impressive citadel and stronger city walls. Instead, even the largest houses suggest a well-off family with servants, but not an elite far above the ordinary people living in the city. However, since the poorer people would have probably not lived in homes made of fired bricks, their homes would not have survived. So we can know less about the people living outside the city walls or in villages in the region. What's equally striking is the uniformity that emerged in all these cities. Earlier regional traditions seem to have come together to form a consensus about how things should be done and measured throughout the Indus civilization. Fired clay bricks were almost all made in the same mathematical proportions, 1 to 2 to 4. There are also cubical stone weights arranged in mathematical proportion that are uniform throughout the civilization. Further, over hundreds of years, the walls of the houses were built on the same place, showing that people recognized long-term boundaries. This kind of standardization throughout such a vast territory, especially in the absence of evidence about an autocratic ruler, suggests a strongly shared cultural consensus by the people living in and managing these many Indus civilization cities. We might imagine a cooperative, multi-city class of merchants concerned with purity, safety, and order. Further, archaeologists have found thousands of stone seals with animals carved on them, and also clear writing, which is especially exciting. These seals are square-faced with flat surfaces, often with a loophole in the back so they could be suspended from a string around one's neck or hung on a peg on the wall. These seals were pressed into soft clay, perhaps like a signature or mark of ownership, again suggesting mercantile activity. Some scholars have tried to find similarities or common origins between the Indus writing system and that of the nearest other civilization, the Mesopotamian. But any apparent similar features may have come instead from independent invention, when people from each of the two civilizations came up with similar representations for physical objects that they saw. Also, the Mesopotamian civilization used tubular seals with round faces that were rolled instead of pressed into soft clay. These Mesopotamian seals were therefore produced in using repeated patterns, more like a narrative than a single frame of the Indus seal. Unlike those contemporary Egyptian, Mesopotamian, and Chinese civilizations, the Indus form of writing has not yet been deciphered. Many people around the world have already tried, and some have compiled over 400 characters in order to find patterns in them, which is the common way to start deciphering a language. But perhaps most of these are only names and not sentences with grammar. In that case, the task would be as difficult as trying to reconstruct English from a telephone book, which is also mainly only lists of names and numbers. Many animals on these seals can also provide insights into the Indus culture and natural environment. Some of the animals are direct representations of actual creatures, including humped bulls, so we can assume that these were animals that the Indus people had as livestock. Animals like the rhinoceros seem to have been very common locally, while others, like the elephant, seem to have been famously rare. But many images are unrealistic combinations of several natural animals, such as a tiger's stripes on an animal with bull's horns. So the Indus people were not just copying animals, they were sometimes creatively altering nature. In addition, some of the images have animals in a cultural setting. For example, one recurrent image has a bull-like creature standing in front of an elaborate object. Different scholars have seen it as a manger from which the bull is eating, or as the bull is facing a lamp or brazier, or as the bull is tied to a sacrificial altar for ritual slaughter. A few highly refined busts and other sculptures have also been found. These must have been very costly to commission. One of the most famous shows the head of a man with a fillet that may have held a gem and an embroidered or brocade woven robe. His features, including straight hair and eye shape, may suggest his ethnic origin, perhaps from Iran or Central Asia. Many people have seen in this man's demeanor the confidence of a leader, either a priest or a civil authority. Another striking object is the thin, graceful figure of a young woman, perhaps in a dancing pose. But lacking any indigenous explanation or context, we can only speculate about the intent and purpose of these works of art. Less polished, but more frequently found, are simpler clay images of men and women. Some of these images seem to have features of both men and women. They were evidently made in two parts, the upper and lower, separately, and then joined in the middle. Scholars have written about these types of images as children's toys, as objects of worship, or as expressions of indigenous ideas about human bodies and gender. Further, there are some models of wheeled carts, evidently pulled by domesticated animals. These may have been children's toys, but they suggest the technology used by the civilization, especially for moving the large volume of grain from the surrounding villages to the city, where it was evidently stored in large granaries. These granaries have grooves in the entry, apparently for the cart wheels to pass through. They were also well sealed, perhaps against pilferage by animals or people. A few graveyards have also been discovered. These indicate that at least some people were buried in wooden or stone coffins rather than cremated. In these graves, men, women, and children were carefully interred, often with food and some other simple grave goods. This suggests that they were being honored and probably provisioned for an afterlife. The most valuable jewelry, however, was not put into the graves, but probably inherited. Some of these are highly worked gold ornaments. Semi-precious stones, amber, and fired beads have also been worked into impressive jewelry by careful drilling, polishing, and mounting. Clearly, the skills of jewelers to create such jewelry were extremely well developed, with enough wealth to commission or purchase such works of art. Artisans also worked with copper, bronze, shell, and ivory carving, and stonework to make implements and ornaments. Terracotta pottery and other ceramics were more widely available, some of which have survived over the centuries. These served as pots, bowls, and plates. There are also a few clay masks with stylized faces, suggesting either rituals or performances. There is so much more we want to know about this complex culture. We can be sure that the Indus people traded up and down the Persian Gulf with parts of the Mesopotamian civilization. Burial mounds in Bahrain, for example, contain lapis lazuli and other stone artifacts that can be traced using chemistry to quarries in the mountains surrounding the Indus civilization, which probably exported them via long-distance trade routes. Mesopotamian records, for example, indicate that the level of trade reached many tons of copper. Just as tantalizing as the origin and way of life of the Indus civilization are the reasons for its decline and dispersal. For a civilization so extensive and well-organized as this, there were probably a number of contributing factors. It is clear that the Indus cities did not suffer after a violent end, but rather a gradual decline and emigration of its population, who carried their culture with them. One contributing factor seems to have been the regional climate change. We can tell from the types of animals depicted and the water control systems in place that most of these cities came up along riverbanks, and that there were once well-watered and even marshy lands nearby. These rivers encouraged trade, both locally and regionally, up and down them, between cities, and also downstream into the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf for long-distance trade. But most of the land where this civilization stood is now dry and desiccated, incapable of sustaining such a high level of agriculture necessary for the urban-based economy we know was once there. Some of this may have been a natural process. For example, the Indus River and its branches have long since shifted their course away from where it was during the period of the Indus civilization. There is some evidence that a river, sometimes later identified as the Ghaghra Hakra or the Saraswati, silted up or dried up. With less access to river-based trade, the commercial economy would also have declined. But there may have been more dramatic natural factors at work as well. A series of massive floods down the Indus River may have disrupted the economy and society, leading to a decline. Another possible hydraulic explanation comes from geological evidence that the region where the Indus and other rivers debouched into the sea was pushed up by the same forces that moved the entire Indian tectonic plate into Asia. This meant that these rivers backed up, first flooding the lands upstream and then diverting to another course to the sea. when we probe beneath the land's surface, we can see ancient riverbeds that no longer flow or do not reach the ground level. Such changes would devastate this civilization's agricultural and trade-based economy. There is supporting evidence from the flood-affected upper, that is, the most recent, layers of bricks in the walls of many of these cities. Other possible contributing causes were human-made. A vast amount of wood would have been needed to fire the huge number of bricks that this culture used to build walls and houses. More wood was needed to make artifacts and cook food. It's possible that the culture itself deforested the surrounding area, reaching out ever farther over time, as local forests disappeared, but the need for wood increased. Such deforestation would have increased soil erosion as well as desiccation of the environment, making this a possible example of a very early human-made environmental disaster. As the economy evidently declined, the people living in this region would have emigrated to more productive lands. Some probably migrated southeastward and eastward to regions where their farming methods would have thrived. We can use linguistic and other cultural evidence to support these broad migration patterns. In South India today, there are four major languages, as well as many smaller ones, that are collectively known to linguists as the Dravidian language family. These are closely related to each other, but not to any other known language except one smaller Dravidian language, Brahui, whose speakers today are located in the hilly upland of today's Pakistani province of Balochistan, just northwest of where the Indus civilization was based. A plausible theory is that most of the Indus people migrated to the southeast, but some remained nearby. In this way, the Indus language would survive, although linguists have not yet proven this origin. None of the written forms of the Dravidian languages are at all similar to the Indus script seen on many seals. In addition, most of these Dravidian language speakers consider themselves to be indigenous in their current regions, with Emuc accounts of their origins there rather than as immigrants. Even less clear are the connections between the Indus civilization and people in North India. Some scholars have seen in the Indus seals figures and features that they've identified in popular religious and cultural traditions in North India. Other scholars see these similarities as the result of independent invention, since bulls, for example, are found in many agricultural economies, and their power often makes them seem to represent divine forces. But many scholars see likely ancestral connections between the large majority of men and women now living in North India and the people who lived in the Indus civilization. Their farming skills and knowledge of mathematics and civil engineering would have come with them as they migrated eastward. As we'll see in the next lecture, though, the Vedic culture also entered India, eventually basing itself in North India and probably dominating the cultures already present there, both the Adivasi and also the displaced Indus. As we've briefly seen in this lecture, the Indus civilization is fascinating, yet also frustratingly difficult to understand. We would like to do more archaeological excavation, but some of the prime areas are in politically troubled parts of Pakistan, where it may be dangerous to dig. Also, there are towns right on top of some areas, including above parts of the Indus cities that we've already know about. So we can't displace those people and tear down their homes and businesses in order to dig beneath them. Worse, the changes in groundwater brought about in the past century by human agricultural irrigation and also by natural forces like exposure of the excavated areas to the destructive weathering of rainfall are all continuing to crumble the bricks that remain from some of these cities, making preservation of what had been unearthed difficult and exploring further even harder. Finally, the ancient and remarkable nature of the Indus civilization makes it a continuing political issue today. On one hand, it hasn't received the same level of international attention as have its contemporary Egyptian, Mesopotamian, and Chinese civilizations. since the connection between the ancient Indus people and the current people of Pakistan and India today is not as evident. Thus, no government has highlighted the Indus as part of its national ancient heritage. While there's some effort by the new nation of Pakistan to claim its roots in that 5,000-year-old Indus culture, many Pakistani citizens would rather look to their country's Islamic heritage. Likewise, the current government in India celebrates the Hindu roots of its culture, which, as we'll see, often go back to its origins other than the Indus, namely to the Vedic culture. In the next lecture, we'll look at that more highlighted Vedic tradition. Along with the Adivasi and the Indus, this is the third source from which not only Hinduism, but also other Indian cultural traditions developed.